Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. Radiation, worms, microbes, and their survival on the Moon is our topic in episode 45. Biological systems can be affected by many things. Ionizing radiation and gravity are two of them. Sharmila Bhattacharya is a NASA Space Biology Program scientist. In January of 2021, she described the stressors on biological systems.
Ionizing radiation and altered gravity are two of the very important stressors that we're interested in. For one thing, they're novel stressors. They're not things we experience on the Earth's surface typically. And then they're also things that are hard to mimic accurately on the ground, and we'll get to that in a second. I have a finite time to this presentation, I'll only give you a few examples of some of the studies that we have to look at what are the combined effects, as we know it right now, of ionizing radiation and altered gravity. And then, you know, the possibility is you have an amplified effect, either additively or synergistically increased because of these two stressors. You can have no effect, or you can have a suppression. The bottom line, though, really, at the end of the day, is that at this point in time, we have very limited understanding, really, of how living organisms will respond for this long durations in these deep space environments and in response to all these various spaceflight stressors that we mentioned previously on the top here. Therefore, it's critical to expand our knowledge base to enable us to better prepare for our journey for those long durations on the surface of the Moon and Mars in the future. So here I'm going to give you three examples only due to limitations in time. This one comes using the Drosophila melanogaster, or the fruit fly system, where adult males were sent to space on a shuttle mission for 8 days. So adult males were sent and returned. They were mated after they returned. And the F2 generation of offspring were looked at, and the number, the frequency of lethal mutations was measured on the X chromosome, the X chromosomes that were inherited from the grandfather that was in space. You see that there's a significant increase both in wild type and in the radiation sensitive mutant line for the frequency of lethal mutations on the X chromosome from spaceflight. Interestingly, this study from this Japanese group, what they did is they also looked at somatic mutations. So they looked at changes in the wing hair morphology of adults. So here what they did is, instead of sending the adults like they did here, they sent larvae, which is, you know, one of the life stages in the fruit fly's life cycle. And the larva was sent into space, and then the pupae, which is the cocoon stage, returned. And then the adults were checked for these wing hair somatic mutations. And the pupal period is actually an important one. A lot of tissue remodeling occurs at this period during metamorphosis. And so interesting, what you find is there really was not a significant increase, in fact, not at all, increase in the frequency of these mutations coming back from spaceflight seen in the adult. So what's interesting here is that in this particular case, because there's remodeling, there's the scope that if there were mutations, they could be repaired. If there are flies in the population that don't survive due to damage, you know, they could get selected out of the population and you wouldn't score them. So I brought this example up as an example of when constructing, you know, experiments, for example, to look at the effects of this environment. A couple of things are important. It's you know, you can look at cells and tissue systems, etc., that will carry the imprint of the damage through generations. You can also look at, and the point to make here is numbers. So you can see the number of chromosomes that were looked at here were 9,000. And so it's important, again, to have systems because the radiation effects are low probability events, even though they're very damaging and can really affect biology. So, but being low probability events, your sample size number becomes important in this case. This is another example. This is from plants, and really it's this top. So I've 1, 2, 3, you know, I've shown you examples of a few different things, but really it's this number one on top that I wanted to point your attention to. So this is using Arabidopsis thaliana seeds. And this experiment that was done by this group was on a satellite. It was the LDEF mission. And it went for almost 6 years with the seeds. And the way this was done is using the biostack concept. So in other words, you had the seeds. So you had a radiation sensitive film, and then you have the seeds, you know, juxtaposed with it so that you could see which seeds had been impacted by radiation during the mission. And what this group found was that from long duration study, looking at ambient radiation levels in space. Oh, and I should also point out that the satellite was higher than the International Space Station. It flew at, you know, almost 480 kilometers compared to 350 kilometers above Earth's surface for the ISS. And this study found that for those seeds that had been hit by radiation and were in spaceflight, there was a significant increase on phenotypes, example seed germination and mutation frequency. So I thought this was an interesting study. This was another one, but this one had pre-flight gamma. It also showed on the last line that the longer duration with pre-flight gamma and spaceflight caused the biggest decrements in phenotype. However, a major caveat to this one is that the pre-flight gamma irradiation that was given on the ground before flight was a very, very large dose, and in a sense, not a dose that would be experienced nowhere near what would be experienced in flight. This, on the other hand, the first experiment I pointed was ambient radiation. Since then, there have been other experiments with Arabidopsis seeds using other hardware, reporting other things. But bottom line, again, is we don't really have a whole lot of data and experiments done to look at the effects of deep space-like radiation over long periods of time.
Biologist Sharmila Bhattacharya. Let's go back to Sharmila, speaking in January of 2021 as she considers the instrumentation that will be required.
Here, just to summarize the biology, and again, remember, I just had time to show you a few examples. Microbes, you know, we know that bacteria, eukaryotic systems, these also show changes in spaceflight. And so the idea is that we, you know, many organisms show changes during spaceflight. I won't go and recap this part. There are many different mechanisms that could be contributing to some of the combined effects of radiation and reduced gravity in multicellular and embryonic systems. There could be other mechanisms occurring in single cell systems. But bottom line here again is we need to use various organisms, prokaryotic and eukaryotic, that are amenable to space flight to look at the effects of space flight stressors. We, NASA has done some experiments with free flying missions. These are automated experiments done with biological systems like bacteria and yeast. Some of this technology might be useful to do future experiments on the lunar surface. The next three slides, and I will race through these, actually talk about spectrometers, so radiation dosimeters that can be useful, that have been developed. This one by NASA, by the Radboud's team, going to be used in BioSentinel, which is an LET spectrometer. So it measures particle counts, the energy of the particles, and the time of arrival of particles, and gives you a mapping. Our other radiation dosimeters that NASA, ESA, and JAXA have built, developed, and then the next one, please, as well, that NASA can use, and ESA, JAXA, and everybody around the world can use in conjunction with their biology to map the radiation environment in the context of their science. Therefore, just to sum up this, then, we need to utilize the moon to study the effects of individual as well as combined stressors, especially radiation and altered gravity, because these are hard for us to replicate accurately on the ground. So the moon, serves as a great environment to test this. Possibly we're going to have to start with simpler, smaller, more robust organisms, like bacteria, yeast, worms, fruit flies, and so on, and other invertebrates and single cell systems, and then progress to larger, more complex organisms as the technology matures. We will also probably initially maybe have to do shorter duration experiments as the technology allows, but really our end goal should be to do longer duration missions so that we can test getting ready to get to Mars. Along with the science, of course, the technology advancements are important to consider. They go hand in hand. And I think it's important also to focus on the important underlying mechanisms of change, the genetic and physiological susceptibilities of biological organisms, so that once we understand that better, we are in a better place to look for countermeasures and make sure that we can do this, in a safe and comfortable manner.
Nate Suzuk is a professor at Ohio University. He has been pondering what types of organism to fly in space to study space organisms. Remember Arabella the spider on Skylab, or the Australian spiders flown by students from Glen Waverley on the ill-fated Columbia's STS-107 mission? Perhaps spiders would be the obvious candidates for future space biology experiments. Well, Nate doesn't think so. His candidate might surprise you.
Thank you. Thank the organizers for having me to chat about worms on the moon. So the talk is a bit different. I'm really going to focus on C. elegans as a model organism for spaceflight, specifically with a focus on the moon. And I'm not going to focus particularly on specific scientific questions. Why fly animals versus tissue chips? And so my argument here is that we can do some studies using C. elegans, and I'll make some arguments about why. So yesterday we heard about the idea of trying to study human biology on the moon and trying to understand the hazards and trying to actually understand how we can model that in an integrated way in space using model organisms, astronauts, and studies on Earth. So this recent review by a number of investigators from space biology and HRP kind of focuses on how we can think about doing that. And this other recent review by some folks associated with NASA Gene Lab and international partners talks about the idea that we can use various model organisms to try and understand the gene expressions in response to spaceflight, and hits on the idea that there are pros and cons of the various model organisms. So my focus right now is really just on C. elegans. Yesterday, we also heard about astrobiology from a NASA perspective, and NASA basically will, or NASA astrobiology community will disagree with this slide because they've specifically said that they're not interested in the evolution of life beyond Earth. Whereas I would argue internationally that that's probably an interesting question. And so I do think that one of the interesting things to do with C. elegans is you could potentially look at how life evolves off the planet. So worms, for those of you who don't know, are microscopic. They have multiple organ systems. The development is sensitive to environmental conditions. Life history is also sensitive to environmental conditions. And from an evolutionary perspective, they're actually the most advanced animal to be endemic to all of the continents on Earth. You can also find them at high altitudes and at low depths in the soil and in the ocean. And interestingly, you can actually find mutations that are reproducibly imposed by natural stressors in the lab within 3 years. And so, for example, in my own work looking at muscular dystrophy, we can actually capture spontaneous mutations that improve the health of the worms basically every 6 to 8 months. And then obviously we've started studying worms in space. So in terms of what's been done with worms in space, and so the title of the talk is basically an homage to Greg Nelson from Loma Linda, who started this work. We found that males can actually mate successfully. Worms can undergo 2 generations in flight. There are no gross morphological defects, but they do experience an increased rate of mutation. And in a follow-on experiment using a biostack, Greg was able to show that that increased rate of mutation is specifically due to exposure to radiation and not to any other kind of mythical factors associated with spaceflight. I think one of the things that we keep learning in spaceflight is that conditions are important. So a follow-up experiment, which was done with some high school students, the worms didn't survive, presumably because they were sealed in a hermetically controlled or an airtight container. And this continues to be a problem, say, with the student spaceflight experiment program that NanoRacks helps sponsor. And we again heard about some of the challenges of doing that in hardware yesterday. One experiment where the shuttle didn't return, we actually were able to recover worms from that particular experiment, which does have some implications for astrobiology and the spread of life by natural means. So in terms of experiments done on station, there's been several. So again, unsurprisingly, much as worms can grow and develop on shuttle without any real problems on station, they grow and develop largely normally. Programmed cell death proceeds largely normally. Rates of mutation are largely normal, which may be surprising. But again, if you think of the station as being a shielded environment, that should be a good thing, and that's normal and expected if the worms aren't exposed to elevated levels of radiation on a particular flight. That said, if you start looking more closely at worms, you do find some interesting things to follow up on. So, for example, telomeres appear to be elevated or seem to be elongated, which has recently been reported in the twin study. Also seems to be an increased incidence of DNA breaks. Muscle development does actually seem to be altered in a similar way to rodents and astronauts. And that's largely based upon looking at changes in gene expression across those 3 species. By flying things multiple times, we can see that things are reproducible. So those changes in gene expression are reproducible. We can also start to do interventional studies. So we've shown that RNA interference works successfully in space. So there's nothing preventing that from happening. And we can use that to alter, say, protein degradation in muscle. And again, in terms of thinking about moving beyond station, we've been able to successfully grow worms on the station for 24 generations or 6 months. So that does enable things like evolutionary studies and interplanetary missions. More recently, we focused on the changes in muscle. So we've actually identified a transcription factor that seems to be controlling gene expression changes in space. Still finalizing a few experiments on that. And then in a paper that's in press at the moment at iScience, we found that neuronal morphology is altered and the protein degradation in response to neuronal abnormalities, say with Alzheimer's, is actually altered in space. So in terms of how these experiments get done, they can be active experiments, they can be passive experiments, creates a lot of flexibility, but also technical challenges in terms of thinking of the moon. Thinking about the moon and whether or not you're going to have the ability to get samples back, do need to start thinking about ways of doing experiments without having sample return. So one way to do that is video-based. And this is basically enables automated culturing of worms across multiple generations. And the worm health can then be monitored just using video. In this particular case, the samples were returned, but that would be optional for something like a moon mission. SIVA has an experiment that's slated to go up next month on NG15 that also uses video. And so there's a worm that pushes against pillars. So we can not just look at, say, overall health and morphology, but we can measure things like muscle strength. So thinking about, say, unmanned platforms, CubeSats, interplanetary missions, we've been kind of scoping the idea of having a biology payload as, if you will, an instrument on an interplanetary mission, specifically thinking about something like a Mars mission. So we've been developing what we're kind of calling a Petri pod, which is effectively the size of a tissue culture dish, can be configured in multiple ways for multiple well types. Obviously, things become airtight and it's video based in terms of actually looking at the health of things inside of them. Obviously, it doesn't have to be worms. It could be other microbes. And then in terms of thinking about planetary protection for taking something like this and actually sending it off planet, one of the things that we've incorporated into the device is a way to actually kill the organisms, so to prevent any kind of forward contamination.
Humanity, and indeed all life on Earth, has always had a struggle to defend itself against microbes. Although they did come to our aid in H.G. Wells' gripping yarn, War of the Worlds. The question we face as we head off-world is how will microbial growth be affected? Before we ask Catherine Bywaters of Honeybee Robotics to discuss the issue, we should explain that a CubeSat is a small spacecraft based on multiples of a cubic decimeter.
So why? The motivation behind this was to understand how conditions of outer space and lunar regolith impact microbial growth and survivability. I'm not going to go into too much detail about this because we've heard some great talks on how microgravity and radiation do affect biology, but just want to reiterate that these aspects actually affect microbiology as well, and that has been shown. Also, for lunar regolith impacts, there's potential impacts of lunar regolith on microbial growth and survivability. But there is this big knowledge gap that we really don't understand all the impacts that these factors can have on microbial growth. So the current methods for observing microbial growth in the space environment have mainly consisted of platforms on the ISS or CubeSat. And these platforms are very versatile, but they do have some drawbacks. For the ISS, they're often part of a larger system and require manual operations. And this is important for potential uses of going to the lunar surface on a lander. You do need a fully automated system, which the CubeSat platforms offer. However, they're not designed for sample addition. Here, just showing you on the bottom is the BioSentinel platform that's going to be a payload on the EM-1 mission. And it's a enclosed microfluidics card that has dried yeast in it. Once the payload is launched and ready to initiate, the microfluidic channels are wetted and the yeast is activated and then monitored by dye. So this is a great technology that we can leverage and draw on and really bring our capabilities up to meet our needs for a lunar lander environment. The solution that we've obtained is a sample delivery system via PlanetVac to an automated standalone microbial growth and analysis instrument. And really the key here is automated. We need a fully automated system to really take advantage of the sort of these earlier lander opportunities to run science payloads. So PlanetVac actually can replace or be mounted on a lunar lander foot pad or any lander for this matter. And how it works is gas is used to as a boom to sweep or loft the material. The foot comes in contact with the regolith, the gas jets in yellow are initiated, and that's what lofts the material up through via momentum exchange up to the actual instrument. This pneumatic system is very efficient, about 1 gram of gas lofts 100 grams of powder, and It has flight heritage, uses cold gas propulsion components that have been flight proven components, but the sampling head and delivery system is mission dependent. So that TRL can range from low to high. The benefits of this is the simple operations. It's just an actuator valve, opens a valve, you get your gas, and then it really, a really simple system delivers that lunar regolith to the instrument. There's short sampling times. This all happens very quickly. It's gravity agnostic. The sample delivery location is independent from the sample acquisition location. I want to point out this as well, because with a lot of the landers, you don't actually have to have specific instrument locations near the sample acquisition and handling mechanisms this way. You can decouple those systems so that you don't have additional requirements on your science payload as to the location of the lander it needs to be located. So that is just an added benefit of this system. The lunar regolith is mixed with a growth media, and that growth media is pumped in and then out of the sample cup. There is a filter on the bottom of that sample cup so that your larger particles will remain in the sample cup, but your smaller particles will be allowed to move throughout the system. This mixture is then fed into the microbial culture wells. What happens is the microbes are desiccated inside the microfluidic wells. And then once the lunar lander has received the sample, has landed, PlanetVac has delivered the sample to the system, then that microfluidic well is wetted out and the experiment can be initiated. And the growth, morphological, and fluorescent characteristics can be observed via microscopy.
You have to be clever to be a space biologist at NASA. Not only do you need to know your subject, you have to think up meaningful acronyms. To you and me, Soteria was the Greek goddess of safety and delivery from harm. But to Jessica Lee of the Ames Research Center, Soteria means searching for organisms through equipment recovery at impact areas.
With the Artemis program, NASA is sending humans back to the moon for the first time in decades. And I'm here to argue that while the humans are there, they should spend a little time picking up some of the stuff that we've left lying around from previous missions and bring it back to Earth to see whether there's any microbial life still living there. So this is going to be a slightly different kind of biological experiment than you've been hearing about up until now. This was the topic of a white paper that my co-authors and I submitted to the Planetary Science and Astrobiology Decadal Survey this past summer, and it's also what I'm going to talk to you about today. But before I go into the details of the mission concept, I'll start with a little bit of motivation. So suppose we've carried out an experiment like this before. In 1969, the crew of Apollo 12 visited the Surveyor 3 lander, which had been on the moon for about 2.5 years at that point. And they brought back the camera. Back on Earth, microbiologists swabbed the camera inside and out. And from about 33 samples, only one yielded a live culture of a microorganism, which was identified as Streptococcus mitis, an organism associated with the human mouth and throat. An amazing example of a microbial survivability on the surface of the moon. But was it really? Since then, there's been a lot of criticism levied against this finding, especially with a recent reanalysis of video footage from the sampling event carried out by John Rummel and colleagues. And in summary, there have been observations of multiple occasions in which the scientists themselves could very well have contaminated the sample that they were studying. Add to this the fact that Streptococcus mitis is not an organism capable of forming stress-tolerant spores. So it's not on the short list of organisms that we would have expected to find surviving the lunar conditions for 2 years. So we have a lot to gain by returning to the moon to sample spacecraft debris again and look for microbial life there. You might ask whether we're likely to have any microbial life on spacecraft hardware, given the current stringent planetary protection policies carried out by NASA. So the truth is that planetary protection policies actually can't require absolute sterility of spacecraft hardware. So even the Curiosity rover bound for Mars is estimated to have carried a bioburden of about 1,000 spiable bacterial spores when it left Earth. And hardware destined for the moon is subject to much less stringent regulation, and so probably carries more than that. We talk about microbial spores a lot in this presentation because spores are the biological form that we think are most likely to be able to survive the conditions of space, such as radiation, temperature extremes, and desiccation. So should we care about a few spores on our hardware? The answer is absolutely yes, for a bunch of different reasons. Probably the most obvious one is planetary protection. So we'd really just rather not contaminate other planets with Earth's microbes. But also from a fundamental biological standpoint, we're interested just in learning how earthly life, like microbes, respond to space conditions and whether it's possible for them to disperse across space. And then also from a practical standpoint, for carrying out astrobiology work, if we're doing life detection assays, any microbial contamination, live or dead, is likely to get in the way of that. We think that we should really carry out a case study in planetary protection. And that would mean following some of that microbial contamination on our hardware and finding out what happens to it after we've sent it to space. And the moon is a perfect place to do this for a few reasons. One, as I mentioned earlier, the moon has a low priority status as far as planetary protection goes. And so hardware that goes to the moon is more likely to have microbes on it for us to find. It's also a relatively accessible location, but still has the ability to close some serious gaps in space biology knowledge that include understanding of biocidal conditions beyond low Earth orbit and the effect of spacecraft impact that is crash landing on microbial survival. And then probably the most important thing here is that we already have a model that gives us testable predictions for the bioburden that we should expect to find on any of the spacecraft that are currently on the surface of the moon. And this is from the Lunar Microbial Survival Model, which was published by my colleagues in 2019 with the Core Addendum in 2020. The LMS model combines a set of different biocidal factors and uses them to estimate the temporal rate at which microbes can be expected to be deactivated or killed on the surface of the moon. And number two, we're more likely to find microbes on spacecraft that are at polar latitudes. And this is especially convenient from a sampling point of view because there are Artemis and Commercial Lunar Payload Services missions planned for this lunar South Pole in the next few years. So we've identified a few potential target spacecraft at the lunar South Pole currently, probably the ISRO Chandrayaan 1 moon impact probe, which crashed in 2008. So our colleague Philip Stuck has analyzed some moon impact probe descent images to better pinpoint its most likely location, where it crash landed, deduced that it's most likely at on the connecting ridge between the Shackleton and DeGroote craters, which is quite close to a site that's been proposed for an early Artemis program landing. And so we think it would be accessible, if not by walking EVA, then by a very short rover ride. And so, but that's just one example of a potential target site. So we think that Soteria should have two phases. And the first mission would be an imaging mission to better identify potential target debris sites. Whereas phase two would be where we actually send crew out to sample that debris. And phase two should be actually pretty straightforward. Sorry. Thanks. Phase two should be pretty straightforward because it shouldn't be too hard for crew to recognize hardware against the lunar regolith. And also because really sampling would just amount to picking up the hardware and putting it in a sterile bag. The more interesting work would be done actually on Earth with the analyses. And since those very simple culturing experiments that were done in 1970, we've developed a much more advanced suite of sensitive molecular methods that allow us to detect and identify unculturable taxa, whether alive or dead. So in conclusion, I do want to emphasize that we're not just going on a hunt for live microbes. Even if we don't find any living microbes, the results of this mission would be valuable for basically anyone who cares about microbes in space from a variety of perspectives. Again, from planetary protection standpoint, this would be a first ever true case study in forward contamination. For space biologists, it provides valuable data on the effects of beyond LEO conditions on Earth microbes. And for astrobiologists, it could prove a valuable dry run for sensitive sample collection and analysis techniques that we might want to use down the road in other locations.
Jessica Lee in Mountain View, California. In future, when you hear the word soteria, think not of a Greek goddess, but of microbes on the moon.